From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! At least 13 protesters are killed in Iran in a brutal government crackdown. Hundreds are arrested, including 24 journalists. More demonstrations are planned as Iranian authorities acknowledge for the first time irregularities have been found in the disputed presidential election results. Then President Obama presents his plan to reform the financial regulator system.
I am proposing that the Federal Reserve be granted new authority and accountability for regulating bank holding companies and other large firms that pose a risk to the entire economy in the event of failure.
We'll speak with investment banker turned journalist Nomi Prinz, author of It Takes a Pillage, behind the bailouts, bonuses, and backroom deals from Washington to Wall Street. And in Somalia, the government's declared a state of emergency as fighting intensifies in the capital. Hundreds have been killed over the past month. Some reports say Ethiopian troops are back in the country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iranian authorities have acknowledged some irregularities have been found in Iran's presidential election results. The influential Guardian Council admitted the number of votes collected in 50 cities surpassed the number of people eligible to cast ballots in those areas. Authorities said the discrepancies could affect as many as 3 million votes. According to the official results of the dispute election, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad beat Mir Hossein Mousavi by about 11 million votes. Meanwhile, Mousavi and former Iranian President Mohammad Khatami have defied Iran's supreme leader and urged protesters to continue street demonstrations calling for a new election. Iranian state media reports that between 10 and 19 people were killed during protests on Saturday. Iranian police fired tear gas and water cannons at the protesters. Iranian state radio reported 457 protesters were arrested. On Sunday, Iranian police briefly detained five relatives of former Iranian President Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, a close ally of Mousavi. Reporters Without Borders say Iran is now jailing 30 journalists and cyber dissidents, including Newsweek reporter Mazyar Bahari, who has been held since Sunday. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports European telecommunications companies have helped the Iranian government develop one of the world's most sophisticated mechanisms for controlling and censoring the internet. The monitoring capability was provided at least in part by a joint venture of the German-based Siemens AG and Nokia, the Finnish cell phone company. Using the technology, the Iranian government appears to be engaging in a practice often called deep packet inspection, which enables authorities to not only block communication, but to monitor it to gather information about individuals as well as alter it for disinformation purposes. In other news, Israeli Army Radio is reporting Israel plans to allocate $250 million over the next 2 years for settlements in the occupied West Bank, despite pressure to halt settlement activity from the Obama administration. Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman met with U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon last week and rejected calls for a freeze on the settlements, which are considered illegal under international law.
I say again, settlements are not an obstacle to achieve peace. We know that even before 67, before we established even one settlement, the situation was the same.
Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki challenged Lieberman's claim.
Continuation of the settlement activities will be impossible to create a viable, contiguous Palestinian state on the 67 borders. Nobody shares with Israeli Foreign Minister Lieberman this view that the construction of settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territories has no connection to the peace process or has no influence to the achieving peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
In Iraq, at least 73 people died Saturday when a suicide bomber struck a Shiite mosque near Kirkuk. It was the deadliest attack in Iraq in more than a year. Another 15 people died, too, today in a series of bomb attacks in Baghdad. In Afghanistan, two U.S. troops were killed Sunday when Bagram Air Base came under a rocket attack. Six other people were injured. Meanwhile, an internal U.S. military investigation into a U.S. airstrike on May 4th has confirmed U.S. forces killed at least 26 Afghan civilians and possibly as many as 86. The military released the internal report Friday, but withheld making public a video from the attack despite an earlier promise from General David Petraeus, the commander of U.S. Central Command. In other news from Afghanistan, a New York Times reporter has escaped from the Taliban after being held hostage for 7 months. David Rode was abducted on November 10th, but his kidnapping had been kept a secret by the Times and other Western media outlets. The United Nations has launched an urgent appeal for funds to help the UN respond to the massive humanitarian crisis facing Pakistan. Over 3 million Pakistanis have been displaced in recent weeks due to the Pakistani military's offensive against the Taliban in the Swat Valley. Last week, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, said the Pakistan displacement crisis is probably the world's biggest since events in Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo in the 90s. Last month, the UN appealed for about $540 million from the international community, but only about 35% of the funding has been received. The humanitarian crisis in Pakistan is expected to soon worsen as the Pakistani military prepares to expand its offensive against militants by attacking South Waziristan. World hunger is projected to reach a record high this year, with more than a billion people going hungry every day. This is an increase of some 100 million people over the past year. The Obama administration's proposed offering federal money to colleges and universities to help train students to become spies for the CIA and other intelligence agencies. The Washington Post reports the intelligence officer training program would most function much like ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps, run by the military, with the government subsidizing the cost of school in return for future service. However, unlike ROTC, the students' participation in the spy training program would likely be kept secret. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit against the Federal Bureau of Prisons, challenging the legality of the government's use of secretive prison units, known as Communication Management Units, or CMUs. The units are designed to severely restrict prisoner communication with family members, the media, and the outside world. Most of the prisoners held in the CMUs have been Muslim men, but the units have also political activists, including the environmental activist Daniel McGowan, who is being held at a CMU in Marion, Illinois. Daniel McGowan's attorney, Lauren Regan, appeared on Democracy Now! In April.
The inmates there do call Marion, Illinois, Little Guantanamo. Part of the reason that they call it that is because it is a secret facility. They do feel as if they are being hidden, not only from society at large, but from other inmates in the federal system.
Visit our website, democracynow.org, for our full coverage of the communication management units. The National Rifle Association is opposing a proposed bill that would block gun sales to people on the government's terrorist watch list. Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey plans to introduce the bill today. A new government study found people on the government's terrorist watch list have tried to buy guns nearly 1,000 times in the last 5 years. Federal authorities cleared the purchases 90% of the time because they had no legal way to stop them. Under current federal law, people named on the terrorist watch list can be barred from boarding an airplane or getting a visa, but they can't be stopped from buying a gun. A new poll by the New York Times and CBS News has found 72% of Americans support the government creating a public health care plan similar to Medicare, which would compete with private insurance plans. The poll also found the majority of Americans now believe the government would do a better job than private insurance companies in providing medical coverage. The food giant Nestle has recalled all Toll House refrigerated cookie dough products because of E. coli contamination. The Food and Drug Administration said there's been 66 reports of illness across 28 states since March from the contaminated cookie dough. In Bermuda, Prime Minister Ewart Brown has survived a vote of no confidence. Brown had been criticized for agreeing in secret with the Obama administration to accept former Guantanamo prisoners. Bermuda and the Pacific Island nation of Palau have both accepted a group of Uyghur prisoners who've been held at Guantanamo for 7 years, even though U.S. officials admitted they were wrongly detained. The Uyghurs are Chinese Muslims who could not be returned to China out of fear that they would be imprisoned and tortured. Over the weekend, President Obama joked about the plight of the Uyghurs during the radio TV correspondents' dinner Friday.
Nigga Night has a new take on an old classic. Leave it to Uyghurs. I thought that was pretty good.
Obama also joked about the island nation of Palau.
As I traveled to all these countries, I saw firsthand how much people truly have in common with one another. Because no matter where I went, there's one thing I heard over and over again from every world leader. No thanks, but have you considered Palau?
The Welsh folk singer and language activist Arfan Gwilym has been forced to cancel an appearance at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival in Washington after he was denied a visa by U.S. officials. Gwilym is a prominent campaigner for the preservation of the Welsh language. He was denied the visa because he's been arrested several times while campaigning for bilingual road signs in Wales and for a Welsh language television channel. And the master Indian musician Ali Akbar Khan has died at the age of 87. Khan played a pivotal role in introducing Western audiences to Indian music. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Iran's powerful Guardian Council has admitted that voting irregularities took place in at least 50 cities and that the number of votes cast exceeded the number of voters by a difference of as many as 3 million ballots. But the head of the Guardian Council also insisted the discrepancies were not against Iranian law and countered charges that similar irregularities had occurred in 170 voting districts. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign ministry has accused Western governments of undermining Iran's stability by backing protesters. Reformist presidential hopeful Mir Hussein Mousavi has called for another round of big street protests after a brutal crackdown this weekend. Iranian state media reports that between 10 and 19 people were killed in clashes Saturday. One of those killed was an unarmed young woman named Neda Sultan, who was reportedly watching the protests with her father when she was shot by a member of the Basij. Graphic video of her death is circulating over the internet, and authorities have reportedly canceled memorial services for her at a mosque.
Iranian state radio reports 457 people were arrested on Saturday. According to Reporters Without Borders, some two dozen journalists and bloggers have been arrested since the protests began over a week ago, including most recently Newsweek reporter and filmmaker Mazyar Bahari, a Canadian citizen. This weekend's clashes with security forces followed the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei's stark warning Friday that demonstrators would face consequences if they continued to protest election results.
Struggling on the streets after elections is not acceptable. It diminishes the electoral process and democracy. I call on all sides to put a stop to such actions. These are not correct actions. If they do not stop these actions, then any consequences will be their responsibility.
For more on the situation in Iran, we're joined here at our Firehouse studio by Quddos Ismaili. He is an Iranian-American independent filmmaker and journalist and a part of the Big Noise Film Collective. He's filed several reports from Iran over the last years for Al Jazeera English, Press TV, and Current TV. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here.
So talk about the latest developments over the weekend.
Well, the most important development over the weekend was, of course, the Supreme Leader's Friday sermon, where he came down quite hard on the demonstrators and on the reform movement that he said that he claimed was going to be held responsible if these disturbances continue. He came down quite strongly as well for the election results, claiming that even if there were some discrepancies, as is natural in any election, The elections overall were fair, and they were proof of the Islamic Republic's continued quest for democracy and people's sovereignty. That resulted in huge clashes on Saturday. People were not convinced by his words whatsoever, and the presidential candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi, in a response to the Friday sermon, encouraged people to continue to fight for the right to have free and fair elections. Saturday saw the highest number of casualties. By some numbers, it was called 10 by the official news agencies, and some people have put a number at 50. That's as high as I've seen be reported.
Now, but in terms of the street of protest, they don't appear to be as massive as they were in the early days, right? A lot of it now is our street battles that are occurring between protesters and either security forces or the Basij. Is there any sense that there'll be more huge protests coming up this week?
Well, on Saturday, the reason why the protests were not huge is because the security forces did a very good job of dividing the people who were trying to gather together at the Revolution Square, which is a place where usually these demonstrations happen. So it was the effective use of the military and the paramilitary forces that divided the crowds, and it dwindled into a riot situation.
Talk about the killings.
Well, the killings, the official news agencies have said that at least 7 were killed on that day. And the word is that the majority of the killing is being done by the Basij, by the paramilitary group that is ununiformed and that has been within the Islamic Republic ever since the days of the Iran-Iraq War in the early 80s. By my accounts and by people who I've spoken to in the streets, the way that the killings have happened have been through knives, largely. Which means basically that the Basij, which has lost its arms, a few years ago they asked the Basij to turn in their guns. So people know that the Basij carry knives and other form of ammunition with them. And that is the way the majority of the killings have happened. The famous killing, the killing that has become most sort of renowned across the world, has been with Nedo Soltani, who was killed by a sniper. And that could very well have been a Basij who had not turned in his guns, or it could have been done
this
by...
This is the young woman.
The young woman who
was
who
there
showed,
with her father watching
yes,
what was happening.
Yes. That could very well have been the official, the uniformed military forces.
Is there any indication, there is some report that there may be a rift developing between the regular army forces and the Basij or the other paramilitaries? Right.
From what there are rumors, and none of those have been confirmed, and no one that I've talked to has said that. During the demonstration the past week, there were instances where the demonstrators, who had done a very good job of protecting the police, they would disarm the police whenever the police would come to attack them, but they would protect them. And there was this affinity that the crowd quickly made with the police. And there were stories that the police and the uniformed military was at certain points protecting the demonstrators from the ununiformed or the Basij forces that might have attacked them. So that did happen, and there were eyewitnesses that I spoke to that actually saw that. As far as a formal rift within the military, that has not been talked about yet. The formal rift right now is coming down within the leadership of the Islamic Republic. The way that the supreme leader has called for calm and called for everyone to accept the results of elections has not been accepted by the leaders of the reform movement, and they continue to lobby and within each other and to speak out openly about the elections not being fair and basically defying the supreme leader's call for accepting the results.
What about this, the Guardian Council saying for the first time there may have been irregularities in the voting?
I think what's going to happen in the following weeks, the Guardian Council and the leadership of the Islamic Republic is going to put out more and more numbers that they're going to try to calm down the protesters, to say, yes, we see that there were problems, we're going to look into them, just please, let's all look at this within a legal framework. Ali Larijani, who's the head of the parliament, who's one of the most senior conservative politicians in Iran, he had a very important interview with state television yesterday, in which he basically criticized the Guardian Council muscle for seeming as if they're supporting one candidate over another. And criticizing the Guardian Council is next to criticizing the Supreme Leader for siding with one of the candidates against the other. So this came out openly on Iranian television. And so there are these voices that are trying to bring calm and sanity and trying to be critical from all sides at this point. And there's reports right now from the parliamentary website for that Laura Jani is trying to get an interview with Mousavi himself on national Iranian television.
Kourtos, we're going to break. When we come back, we want to play for you what Obama said over the weekend, what the president said, the right-wing criticism of him, that he should be acting more, the arrest of Rafsanjani's daughter, very significant, and more. This is Democracy Now! We're speaking with Kourtos Ismaili, who is an Iranian-American independent filmmaker. Stay with us. Master Indian musician Ali Akbar Khan died at the age of 87. He played a pivotal role in introducing Western audiences to Indian music. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see the video of this great musician. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, I'd like to ask you about the statement, President Obama is now under fire from the right for not speaking out more forcefully on behalf of the Iranian protesters. He responded to this charge in an interview on CBS News Friday.
The last thing that I want to do is to have the United States be a foil for those forces inside Iran who would love nothing better than to make this an argument about the United States. That's what they do. That's what we're already seeing. We shouldn't be playing into that. There should be no distractions from the fact that the Iranian people are seeking to let their voices be heard. What we can do is bear witness and say to the world that the incredible demonstrations that we've seen is a testimony to, I think, what Dr. King called the arc of the moral universe. It's long, but it bends towards justice.
That was President Obama on Sunday. Kourtos Ismaili, Iranian-American journalist and filmmaker. Your response to the criticism of President Obama from the right in terms of his inaction on the issue of the election in Iran?
What is interesting about the criticisms that are coming from the right is that it's becoming primarily from Senator John McCain. The Iranians know Senator John McCain as the man who sang Bomb Bomb Iran during the elections of last year. The man holds no credibility as far as supporting Iranians or seeming like he's got the best interests of the Iranians at heart. And that, for Iranians and for this issue, that discredits him altogether and discredits this whole attack on President Obama. President Obama's stand, I think, has been the most sensible. And it's amazing that the president of the United States is taking such a sensible stand. And that everyone I've talked to in Iran says the same thing, that we do not need any symbol of Western, especially American, interference in Iran's internal politics. And the fact that America does not have diplomatic relations with Iran really ties its hand as far as how far it can go in really supporting Iran. So the only thing they can do is to just scream as loud as they can, which will be immediately used by the Iranian authorities.
Kourtos Ismaili, give us a brief history lesson. Talk about why, especially, the sensitivity to the United States interfering with Iran.
Mm-hmm. the Western presence in Iran has been there for about 200 years, from the British and the Russian, who took parts of Iran and under control up to World War II. And after World War II, it was the U.S. that stepped in and started supporting the Shah of Iran as their favorite dictator in the Middle East. There was a coup d'etat against a popularly elected prime minister that had come in to nationalize Iranian oil. And that has really remained within the Iranian consciousness ever since 1953. And Iranians harbor deep mistrust for the U.S. that was seen as orchestrating a coup against their popularly elected leadership. In 1979, when the Islamic Revolution took place, the biggest sort of fear of the Iranian people was a repeat of the coup d'etat, and that's why a large reason why the hostage crisis took place. They took hostages to make sure that the U.S. does not come in, invade, or orchestrate another coup again. And that has remained a dynamic within the Iran-U.S. relations, and mistrust on both sides. And at this point that the U.S. does not have diplomatic relations, it really makes no sense for any administration to get political points for seeming like they're standing up with some demonstrators somewhere in order to score points with their constituents here. Over the weekend, and what's amazing is the way the media in the U.S. has been really helping spin this for the Republican right wing. I mean, there were images on CNN and Fox over the weekend of President Obama, I think, buying ice cream for his daughters while the demonstrators in Iran were fighting for their democracy. And they were likening that to President Bush when he was playing golf right after he'd invaded Iraq, and equating the two. It was like, how heartless could Obama be when he could be, I don't know what he could be doing in order to support the Iranians. I think he did the best thing he could do in order to support the Iranians.
I'd like to ask you, in terms of the Iranian Revolution, one of the key figures in the early days of that revolution was Rafsanjani, and now the current government has detained some of his relatives. Can you talk about his role right now in Iran and in the crisis?
President Rafsanjani has held many positions inside Iran. Today, he is the leader of two very important councils, the councils that oversee the relationship between the parliament and the president, and the council that oversees the election of the next supreme leader. So he holds very, very important positions, and he openly supported Mir Hossein Mousavi in this previous elections. His family was arrested yesterday, and they were all freed. At this point, it seems like some of the reports in the Western media that there's going to be an open rift in which the different leaders inside the country are going to start killing each other or jailing each other hasn't really not happened. They've been able to voice their dissatisfaction with each other. Rafsanjani has been lobbying supportedly in Rome, in the holy city of Rome, where the majority of the clerics live. And there's back channels going on that we don't really know about. But as far as we know right now is that there are disagreements. There are more and more coming to the fore. They're being reflected on Iranian television. And disagreements and the leaders of these two disagreements can be said to be the supreme leader on one side, who supports Ahmadinejad, who supports the elections as they stand, and Rafsanjani, who supports Mousavi, who is seen by many Iranians as being behind Mousavi, but at the same time as being the most powerful, the richest man in Iran. There's a lot of resentment towards Rafsanjani at some point. And one of the ways that the President Ahmadinejad got reelected purportedly is that he used some of the sentiment against Rafsanjani, some of the popular sentiment against Rafsanjani as the richest, most corrupt man in Iran to get votes.
Now let's talk a little about Mousavi, the opposition leader, who he was. He was already the leader of Iran. Talk about his significance at that time, what he represents, if he would represent something different. And of course, that's different after the protests than if he was just elected straight out.
Sure. Mir Hossein Mousavi was the prime minister of Iran during the very important periods of the Iran-Iraq War. And he was seen by many to have led internally the country in a way that he protected people's interests at a time of war. And he's very popular for that reason. He instituted all forms of social service networks. The welfare state, in many ways, that Iran has today, he's credited for it.
And it was a war during which the American administration at the time backed Iraq.
Absolutely. It was a popular war. It was a war that people supported inside Iran that was seen as, we are fighting against imperialism that wants to overthrow our regime. And Mir Hossein Mousavi was the head of the state at that time. He went out of politics after the end of the war. After 89, he stepped out, and he continued to be heads of various organizations inside Iran. He's an artist, he's an architect, and he still carried out his personal life until this year. He'd been talked about running in a previous couple of elections, but he never did, and he was tapped to run again. And many think that it was Rafsanjani who tapped him, understanding that he's popular, that because he's been outside of Iranian politics, he's unsullied by the past 20 years of corruption.
Although he was also repressive during his time.
At the end of his term, when the war ended, there was a bout of killings where as much as 5,000 dissidents who had been in jail were killed, and he was the prime minister when that happened. So he was responsible for that. And one of the questions that did come up in these elections, people did ask him formally that, do you apologize for doing that? So this again was aired, this issue was aired and was talked about during the elections.
What did he say?
He didn't answer the question. As far as I know, he did not come out and take a stand on that. He did. I mean, what distinguished him in these elections, I think, was very much his willingness to talk about various issues that other people did not want to talk about. The question of personal freedoms in the street. He talked about, you know, if I'm elected president, I will do away with the morality police. I will do away with controlling people's lives, and I will respect people's private lives, which is a very important grievance that people have towards the way that the Islamic Republic is run right now. And his wife also was credited for talking about how, you know, she believes that women should have a choice whether they should veil or not. These are very important social issues that they took on. There's a wide layer of Iranians who would support something like that.
And that particular point you mentioned, it's been remarked quite often in these protests in the past few days, the high participation level of women in the protests. Mm-hmm. Is that in essence a reflection of this of Mousavi's scene as a candidate that will provide more opportunities for women to participate in everyday life?
Well, I think Mousavi's stand on the question of women and personal freedoms is a reflection of how Iranian society has changed, the role that the women have been playing. The women were given a huge credit for the election of President Khatami 12 years ago. So women have been participating more and more, and I think what the regime is realizing is that you cannot hold back this tide of society that has come to accept the public role of women and the woman's right to participate within any realm of society, and that brings up the issue of women's personal choices as well. So I think Mousavi rode that wave rather than the other way around.
We want to thank you, Quddus, for being with us. Quddus Ismaili is an Iranian-American independent filmmaker and journalist, part of the Big Noise Film Collective, has done a number of reports on Iran over the years. As we turn now to what's happening here at home, the financial crisis. Juan?
Well, last week, President Obama presented his vision for reforming the U.S. financial regulatory system, saying the new regulations would prevent the kind of abuses that created the current crisis. He said they would fundamentally address the, quote, crisis of irresponsibility that took root from Wall Street to Washington to Main Street. The administration's proposal is laid out in an 85-page white paper that Obama described as outlining the most sweeping overhaul of the system since the reforms following the Great Depression.
It is an indisputable fact that one of the most significant contributors to our economic downturn was an unraveling of major financial institutions and the lack of adequate regulatory structures to prevent abuse and excess. A culture of irresponsibility took root from Wall Street to Washington to Main Street. We were facing one of the largest financial crises in history, and those responsible for oversight were mostly caught off guard and without the authority needed to address the problem. It's time for that to change. I am proposing that the Federal Reserve be granted new authority and accountability for regulating bank holding companies and other large firms that pose a risk to the entire economy in the event of failure. As part of these reforms, we will dismantle the Office of Thrift Supervision and close loopholes that have allowed important institutions to cherry-pick among banking rules. We will offer only one federal banking charter, regulated by a strengthened federal supervisor. We'll raise capital requirements for all depository institutions. Hedge fund advisors will be required to register with the SEC. We're also proposing comprehensive regulation of credit default swaps and other derivatives that have threatened the entire financial system. and we will require the originator of a loan to retain an economic interest in that loan so that the lender, and not just the holder of a security, for example, has an interest in ensuring that a loan is actually paid back. By setting common sense rules, these kinds of financial instruments can play a constructive rather than destructive role.
The proposal also includes the creation of a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. In his weekly radio address and internet address Saturday, President Obama defended the proposed agency, saying it would set harsh new rules to stop deceptive lending practices.
And one of the most important proposals is a new oversight agency called the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. It's charged with just one job, looking out for the interests of ordinary Americans in the financial system. This is essential, for this crisis may have started on Wall Street, but its impacts have been felt by ordinary Americans who rely on credit cards, home loans, and other financial instruments. It's true that this crisis was caused in part by Americans who took on too much debt and took out loans they simply could not afford. But there are also millions of Americans who signed contracts they didn't always understand, offered by lenders who didn't always tell the truth. This new agency will have the responsibility to change that.
Economist, journalist, Demos senior fellow, and former investment banker Nomi Prinz thinks that Obama's new plan is not such a sweeping overhaul of the financial system after all. She's the author of the forthcoming book, It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bailouts, Bonuses, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. Her latest article is an assessment of Obama's reform proposals. It's called Obama's New Economic Plan, The Good, the Bad, and the Weak. It was just published in Mother Jones. She joins us here in our Firehouse studio. Before you comment on the whole plan that was laid out, this latest news, you used to work at Bear Stearns and you worked at Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs has just said that their staff can look forward to the biggest bonus bailouts in the firm's 140-year history. How is this possible?
It is possible because our government has chosen to effectively give Goldman the money to do that in a number of different ways. One is the $10 billion that it got through the TARP program, which both Goldman and the government want us to believe is the only bit of federal subsidy it has gotten, which is why when it said it would pay back the TARP program, it was all this gesture of we're healthy, we're good, we're paying it back, we didn't really need it, but really they didn't want government oversight attached to it, not that there was a lot. The bigger amount of money that has gone to Goldman has come through $12.9 billion from the AIG bailout that went straight to Goldman, its biggest counterparty, $28 billion worth of FDIC-backed guaranteed debt, meaning the FDIC put up a program last fall, and it said for banks that deal with consumers, not banks that deal with multi-billion-dollar companies or investors, but people, we will provide guarantees for debt, which means that those companies can raise debt to help consumers cheaply. Goldman said, all right, fine, we'll take some of that. And they took $28 billion worth of that, and they have up to $35 billion that they can take under the FDIC program that was never meant for a company like Goldman Sachs. In addition, there is a ton of money. There are trillions of dollars at the Fed, not all of that went to Goldman, but that has secretly gone to a number of banks in the system, of which Goldman is one, for which the Fed refuses to disclose any information or any detail, which also goes into this. So when Goldman says, has the nerve to say, feels entitled to say, that it's going to pay its bankers record bonuses after the travesty that it and other banks have created in the markets, it is on the back of federal subsidies that effectively come from our pockets.
Well, I think you've made the point that the $780 billion TARP money is only a small portion, that the actual federal support for the banking industry is about $13 trillion?
That's exactly right. The media has constantly focused, and Wall Street has been very happy about this focus on this measly, and I say measly, $700 billion worth of TARP money that Congress allowed to be allocated last October. And that money has gone out to a number of banks, including Goldman and J.P. Morgan and Bank of America, Citigroup, and other banks. But in addition to that, there have been over $2.5 trillion worth of guarantees and other types of subsidies from the Treasury Department, over $7.5 trillion from the Federal Reserve, of which a lot has gone through the New York Federal Reserve during the Tim Geithner period when he was running it, as well as the Federal Reserve component in Washington, and then all these extra FDIC guarantees, which have the backing of the Fed and the Treasury Department. So we're talking about almost 13.6, actually, now. The count keeps going up every time I look at it. $1 trillion worth of subsidization of the banking industry. $700 billion is a part. It's a big part. But there are so many more trillions that just do not get the right coverage and the right perspective from the media that exist, that are secret, some are not, but it's a lot of money. It could basically pay for every single mortgage in this country and health care and subsidizing student loans. So when it wants to, the government can come up with a way to subsidize what it wants to subsidize. It chose to subsidize the banking industry.
Naomi Prinz, let's talk about how this fits into what President Obama just laid out this past week.
Well, so Obama said a couple of things in his proposal's 88-page white paper that will be created into a big congressional 400 or 500 or 600-page paper for debate probably later in some sort of an act. There were three things that he basically proposed. And we talked, you had a clip just now on the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. That is a good idea. It is high time there is some agency in Washington that is on par with the SEC or the Fed or other regulatory bodies if this agency can be given that kind of enforcement and power. The agency that would look at mortgage loans being more transparent and safer for individuals, potentially capping credit cards, and most importantly, making sure that the banks who issue the loans and who also package them up and sell them globally and make tons of money on it actually have to keep some of those loans and some of those packages on their own books. So if there are losses, they get hit with the losses. That's the part that the banking industry has gone up in arms about. This one agency is the part that the Wall Street banks have been most upset about, which is why we know that it could be the best part of his proposal if it gets the play and the enforcement capabilities it deserves. But it's going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight. The other things that this proposal did was a little bit of a shuffling of deck chairs, unfortunately, in the regulatory system. We had something called an Office of Thrift Supervision, which was effectively responsible for monitoring SNLs. And the most problematic SNL, which was AIG. Now, we think of AIG as an insurance company slash hedge fund slash a thing that took $220 billion worth of federal subsidies because its systemic failure would ruin the world. However, AIG is actually classified as an SNL. The Office of Thrift Supervision, which is not equipped to deal with an SNL of the complexity of an AIG, which isn't really one, failed in that responsibility. They're being deleted, and they and another regulatory body in Washington, the Office of Comptroller of the Treasury, will be consolidated into a new regulatory agency called the National Banking Supervisor. Those are two things.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the, I guess, the nuclear bomb of the of all this financial crisis, which was the question of all of these unregulated derivatives and credit default swaps that were occurring basically outside the banking system, and that the Obama administration is now claiming that it will attempt to regulate. But you're a little skeptical about what you've seen so far of the proposal, right?
The proposal has said, quote, it will regulate standardized OTC, which are over-the-counter, these types of derivatives. Standardized meaning the ones that basically are so generic, they're not actually that harmful. What was harmful in this particular saga were things called CDOs, which were collateralized debt obligations, which were packages of derivatives and all sorts of other things combined with loans and other types of securities. And $2 trillion of those were issued. But the leverage or the amount that banks could borrow on the back of that ranged from 10 to 30 times. So a $2 trillion set of stuff became something like a $20 trillion to $60 trillion set of risk. Those are things that will not be under the Obama plan for regulation. And again, these are things that have been lobbied substantially by the banking industry. Do not take the least generic things, the most complex things that we can make the most amount of money out of, because neither the regulators nor our investors, frankly, really understand what we're doing in them. Do not take those away from us. And the administration was like, okay, but we're going to create this sort of sweeping, standardized regulatory system for some of the derivatives. Will it help a little bit? Yes. Will it help the real problem? No, it will not.
You referred to this, Naomi, in discussing Goldman Sachs, but the bigger picture of what you call the big bank bailout payback bamboozle.
Well, this is part of the $13.6 trillion versus the $700 billion. A couple weeks ago, 10 banks said or were allowed by the Treasury Department to pay back all or a portion of the TARP money they'd received. One was Goldman that had $10 billion, one was J.P. Morgan Chase that had $25 billion, and so forth. The collective money of those 10 banks was $68 billion they would be paying back. They happened to owe $229 billion. The media didn't really mention that part. They only mentioned, oh, the banks are paying back this money, things must be healthy, the financial system must be stabilizing, and all is sort of good. The reality is they owe $229 billion just from the FDIC guarantees they were able to use and from the AIG money. That does not include the trillions of dollars, and this is the biggest problem in all of this, that are on the Fed's books that we do not know how it was divided out among these banks. So we know of $229 billion. We also know there are multiple trillions of dollars on the Fed's books that went out to these and other banks. We don't know how much because they will not disclose that information.
Why aren't they forced to?
Well, this is the biggest part of both the overhaul that Obama has mentioned and also the fact that the Fed is the most powerful regulator already. They're responsible for the banking system. They're responsible for subsidizing it. There have been multiple FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, to the Fed from bodies between, I worked with The Nation to try to get information through, to Bloomberg, to Fox. The entire spectrum of media has tried to get information from the Fed on these loans, and the Fed has basically said, and Bernanke has said this to the Senate and to the House, that this would actually be dangerous. It would be dangerous to give this information out because somehow if people knew, it would create some larger catastrophic situation. The reality is we kind of know who these banks are, the bigger banks have the tightest relationship with the Fed. They actually own portions of the Fed because they actually own shares in the Fed. They have an incredibly symbiotic relationship, and they've gotten trillions of dollars of subsidies. We don't know what the Fed won't say. The Fed hasn't been made to say.
I'd like to ask one last question. Both Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs were allowed in September, right in the midst of the crisis, to turn themselves into bank holding companies overnight. Could you explain the significance of that?
Yeah, there was a chaotic Sunday evening, September 21st, where Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley noted that Lehman Brothers had just fallen apart, that they actually did not have enough money to pay their ongoing day-to-day debts. They were literally about to become insolvent, one or both of these institutions. The only thing that they could do is push the Fed to allow them to become bank holding companies, which would give them access to federal subsidies. Just legally, in terms of the legislative construct, if they get to be a bank holding company, they get more access to our money. So they said, okay, the Fed at night on a Sunday, without even waiting for the 5-day mandatory antitrust period, decided, okay, fine. That enabled Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs to become bank holding companies, to get under the public subsidy tent, and to get a lot of this money, the FDIC guarantees, the Fed backing, and everything else. And that was the Fed's decision. They could have said no. They said, come on, and we'll do it really quick. Just tell us where to sign.
Naomi Prinz, we want to thank you for being with us. Naomi Prinz is an economist. She used to work with Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns. Now she is exposing them. Her article, The Big Bank Bailout Payback Bamboozle, appears in Mother Jones. And her article, Obama's New Economic Plan, The Good, the Bad, and the Weak, is at alternet.org. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
great Indian musician Ali Akbar Khan, who died this weekend at the age of 87. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
We turn now to Somalia, where thousands have fled the capital of Mogadishu as government forces continue to fight opposition Islamist fighters. Fierce street fighting over the past months has claimed hundreds of lives. Just last week, bombs killed two lawmakers, the country's security minister, the police commander of Mogadishu, and nearly two dozen civilians. On Saturday, Parliament Speaker Sheikh Adan Mohamed Madobi urged the neighboring countries of Ethiopia, Kenya, Yemen, and Djibouti to immediately send troops to Somalia. He also asked the wider international community to assist Somalia against, quote, foreign fighters and terrorists.
We are also calling on the international community, especially the U.S., the EU, and the Arab League, to play their role in helping ensure the survival of Somalia from an aggressive enemy of terrorists.
Some news sources, including Al Jazeera, reported Sunday that Ethiopian troops had returned to Somalia. The Ethiopian government spokesperson, however, told reporters that Ethiopia would not invade Somalia without an international mandate. Kenya's foreign minister said Sunday that his country would not, quote, just sit by and watch the situation in Somalia deteriorate beyond where it is. Somalia's Islamist al-Shabaab militia issued a stern warning against any intervention by neighboring countries. Meanwhile, the number of people displaced by the fighting continues to rise. The humanitarian situation is dire, with over a third of the country, that is some 4 million people, dependent on international agencies for aid. Mumina Abdi and her family were forced to leave their home in an impoverished Mogadishu neighborhood for a camp for the internally displaced.
We don't have enough money or materials to build shelter for my children. I used to wash clothes for a living and stayed in the Karan district, but we had to flee from our district to here. We're helpless during the rainy season.
To find out more about what's happening in Somalia now, we're joined from Washington, D.C. by the Somali-American human rights activist and writer Sadia Ali Adan. She is the co-founder of the Somali Diaspora Network. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sadia. Tell us what's happening.
Thank you. Well, what's happening in Somalia is heartbreaking, as you have just described, co-host has described. You have humanitarian crisis, a serious humanitarian crisis, the worst in Africa. Over 1 million people internally displaced, 3.5 million on the verge of starvation. And you have thousands of new internally displaced civilians, as you have just also, Juan has just described, that have resulted from the newly started conflict. So what you have is a government that has been elected in neighboring country, Djibouti, that has arrived in Mogadishu and has thought that it has established a serious base in Mogadishu that has been met with a serious challenge by the opposition groups. And remember, these opposition groups are the same people who were part of the Islamic courts. The Islamic courts, as you remember, has brought 6 months of peace in Somalia, semblance of peace, the best Somalis have seen since the civil war has started. But that in Islamic courts have broken up into two factions now, or three, I should say, which is the government, unity government, united with the Sheikh Sharif group, and al-Shabaab, the military wing of the former Islamic courts. And then you have the Hizbullah Islam, which is led by Sheikh Uwais, which is one of the other leaders of Islamic courts. So they're all struggling for power. And the idea is from the opposition to topple the government. And there is no dialogue. There is no serious reconciliation that's taking place. The civilians are caught in the middle. Whenever also something, a weapon is hit or anything arrives on the side of the African troops, AMISOM, they respond with heavy artillery shelling, which kills civilians. So the civilians have nowhere to go. And those who have arrived in their refuge area, the UN is reporting, particularly women are being raped. And also both sides are not caring for the civilians, and both sides are recruiting children to go frontline under the age of 15, and this is reported also by the UNHCR and UNICEF.
What about the role of Ethiopia and some of the other neighboring countries? Obviously, Ethiopia invaded for a time and then pulled its troops out. What should be the role of these neighboring countries?
Well, the role of these neighboring countries shouldn't be what it has been at the beginning, which was welcome the Somali refugees, civilians, women, children, and elderly, who were fleeing from the conflict between the warring factions, the warlords. But what it has become as soon as the war started, especially with the Ethiopians, was to arm militias against each other, to arm warlords against each other, and to facilitate the continuation of the civil war, the Somali civil war. Therefore, Ethiopia and Kenya have become the enemies who have contributed to the instability of Somalia. And Sheikh Aden Mohammed Noor, Sheikh Aden Madobe, the Speaker of the Parliament, calling for the intervention of these neighboring countries, frontline states such as Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Kenya, was met with shock by the Somali community, particularly those in the diaspora and those who know the brutality of the Ethiopian forces. So he cannot, of course, call for intervention from international court, international world, because Sheikh Aden doesn't have the authority to call. Even the parliament doesn't have, because the parliament, as you know, is a 550 right now, and it's based on 4.5 formula, which is clan-based, four major clans and others, which is the minority groups. So these people in the parliament, the majority of them, do not really represent the Somali people, much the less the clans or the regions that they say they represent.
Sadia,
they can't.
The last time Ethiopia invaded was backed by the United States. What is the role of the United States here? Backed by the United States when a more stable government, the Islamic courts, was in power, that destabilized them.
Absolutely. What the former government, Bush administration, has done was United States has withdrawn from Somalia in 1993 after the infamous Black Hawk down that took the 18 American soldiers and killed thousands of civilians. It was a hands-off policy. And then after September 11th, Bush administration has decided to re-engage, but not with the local authorities, but with warlords. And those warlords have actually went to hunt for traditional leaders, religious leaders, and there was uprising, grassroots uprising, and that was what produced Islamic courts. Those Islamic courts that brought the stability and the peace were toppled by the Ethiopian government, the Ethiopian troops, with the help, of course, of the administration, of Bush administration. And those have fled to Asmara, and then they became Alliance of Liberation of Somalia. They are a former organization, and then they broke up into two, one led by Sheikh Sharif, the other led by Uwais. So what now we're realizing, and we have realized and argued for the longest, was supporting warlords and engaging Ethiopia to take care of the problems of Somalia is not the best way to go. It was a foreign policy that has failed, that has not succeeded. It was misguided. Therefore, Obama administration should take divorce from that foreign policy established from the Bush administration's 8 years of administration, and re-engage Somalia, but engage with the people, engage with the local authorities, not with the warlords, and not to use Ethiopia as intervening or mediating government to take care of the problems of Somalia.
Sadia, about a minute we have left, I'd like to ask you, the Western press has often mentioned the presence of, increasing presence of foreign fighters, many of them supposedly linked to al-Qaeda in Somalia. How accurate is that in your assessment?
They're not accurate. We don't know what's inside Somalia the same way that we didn't know when the earlier administration has also claimed. But what the foreign international community or foreign journalists should do is go inside and investigate and find out the truth about Somalia and make the next process to help this government reestablish peace in Somalia, to be homegrown, home found, and run by the Somalis, the same way that are the two administrations that are built in Somalia, in northeast and northwest of Somalia,
Sandia,
that have succeeded.
Finally, the way we know about Somalia, usually in the United States, is because of piracy, what happens
yes.
to U.S. ships or international ships overseas, I mean, in the high seas. In this last few seconds, can you talk about that issue and how it relates to what's happening in Somalia today?
The piracy is a symptom. It's not the disease. The disease lies on land. It's the Somalia needs a serious political solution. The piracy is resulted from illegal fishing and toxic waste dumping, nuclear waste dumping. And what the international needs community needs to do is introduce a resolution banning all these nations to stop the illegal fishing and the illegal toxic waste dumping in Somalia. And
Sadia, we'll have to leave
Somalia.
It there. Sadia okay. Ali Aden, a Somali-American writer and human rights activist who is co-founder of the Somali Diaspora Network. And that does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Shufa Bokadu, Saren Mate, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Peter Curries, our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.